All right, let's go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jim D. Martini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Gordon Ford is absent.
Jay Raja Far Ford here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Joan Clendenon.
Present and here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, and before I go on to announcements, I've had a request for everybody to speak up loud and clear at today's meeting, if you can do that, please. So now we'll move on to announcements. Do we have any announcements?
I have two announcements. The first announcement is the rotation of officers. Pursuant to bylaw section 1.5, trustee Darren Garrett is chair of the 2017 Board of Retirement, and trustee Mike Lynch is 2017 Board of Retirement vice chair.
Okay, any further announcements?
I have one more announcement. Second announcement is just that in front of you today, you have the form 700 for your 1617 reporting. Those are to you today by hard copy. If you need an electronic copy, I can provide that for you. If you need a copy of last year's, I can provide that by request as well. They are due back to me by March 7th, please, so that I can get them to the clerk recorder for you timely. That's all I have.
I have two announcements. Item 10A, closed session recommendation for non-service connected disability retirement for Jeanette Apolliner. We want to pull that and put that on next month's agenda. There's been some issues with that. And then I'm also pulling item 7C. It's the rescission of the emerging manager policy. There were some issues with the way the agenda item was written, and there were some inconsistencies in it. So we are pulling that one as well.
Okay, any further?
7C and 10A.
Okay, any further announcements? Seeing none, we'll move on to public comment. Is there any member of the public here today that would like to speak on any item not on the agenda? Seeing no hand raised, we'll move on to item 5, the consent calendar. Give everyone a moment to review the consent calendar, then I'll entertain a motion to approve.
Move approval.
Second.
We've had a motion by Jeff Grover, second by Donna Riley, to approve the consent calendar as listed and noted on the agenda. Is there any further discussion, or is any member wishing item pulled? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, we'll move on now to item 6, liquidity mandate. Item 6A, discussion action regarding liquidity portfolio finalists.
So just to give you a brief overview from my perspective, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ed and let him discuss a little more in depth of how we got to where we are today. At the end of November, early December, staff went on a due diligence trip, and we visited four potential managers on the East Coast, two in Southern California. And during those meetings, we discussed regarding the liquidity mandate, the potential managers' processes, whether they felt that they really understood Stanser, what Stanser was doing, the mandate that we were looking to implement, and whether we thought that they'd be a good fit for Stanser's staff and the organization. And so, as you know, staff is recommending two today. And before I turn it over to Ed, I want to iterate what the staff's recommendation is that we're going to be asking you to approve later on. And the recommendations are specifically this: approve the recommendation to allocate approximately $230 million to Dimensional Fund Advisors, approve the recommendation to allocate approximately $100 million to a custom portfolio managed by Insight Investment, authorize staff to engage Scott Smith of Hanson and Bridget to complete the legal review and assist with negotiation and execution of contracts with DFA and Insight, and authorize the executive director to enter into an agreement with DFA and Insight. And so I'm going to turn the first part of this agenda item over to Ed to give you a summary again of how we got to where we are today, and then we will put before you the two potential candidates at this time and give you a chance to ask them any questions that you might have. Ed?
Thank you, Rick.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm glad we're already almost through January. So I'm going to be referencing the handout material that's found separately, which is kind of Blackstone and Barris document. And I'd ask you to turn to page 4, the executive summary. A couple bullet points, just giving you some background dating back to May when we approved the asset allocation that identified the FFP 6-year approach. And then the October meeting when we were presented the slate of 6 investment managers, including 3 solution, 3 product managers. And then, as Rick mentioned, conducting the due diligence, leading us to the recommendation at the bottom of page 4, which outlines exactly what Rick had just shared as far as the recommendation. Turning to page 6, shows the process that we followed, and we want to be clear in terms of how we got to these final 2 recommendations, is that we went through the thoughtful process of conducting an RFI, an RFP, interviewing that slate of firms, getting us down to 6, getting us down to 3. So it's this kind of a funnel, if you will, starting off with 50-some candidates and getting it down to the final 6 that we interviewed in person, and then the final 2 that we're recommending today. And getting into the specific portfolio design is page 8. And so here's where we're first recommending or first showing you how the combination of Insight and DFA are expected to work for the plan. And when we put together the slate of 6 managers, we had Insight positioned as a solutions manager and DFA slated as a product manager. That's just kind of our jargon, just a convenient way of thinking about it. And the idea here is that DFA, as a product manager, does essentially what you're used to seeing with all of your investment managers. We assign them an allocation of capital. They invest it according to their investment philosophy and the investment management agreement. We monitor those returns and such. Insight, however, is a little bit different in a solution mandate. They're very attentive to what our liability needs are and helping us think through what that FFP 6-year component looks like, working with the liability profile of the plan to create the appropriate benchmark and manage the strategy in that way. So it's more tied directly to what we're trying to accomplish rather than just a generic short-term government credit bond fund. And that customization is somewhat unique in the market, and or at least for a lot of public plans, I guess, and something that we think is really valuable here and a nice way of implementing what we were setting out to do. And so that's what page 8 basically summarizes. And page 9 gives us some of the numbers. Okay, so when we put these 2 strategies together, Insight and DFA, in the proportions that we're talking about, what does our overall portfolio look like? Is it consistent with what we expect it to look like, et cetera? And so here you're seeing that it's mainly a corporate bond fund, has some treasury and some government slash related agency bonds in it. And you can see the characteristics, very high quality, so average credit quality of single A, an allocation to triple B, but none below that, so nothing in what is commonly referred to as the junk grade or high yield status allocation. An expected yield of about 2% and a duration of about 3.4 years, which does exactly line up with what we're trying to do in the FFP 6-year model. And then page 10 gives us a quick overview of the allocations and making sure that we're attentive to fees, how the fee schedules work out, and on a blended rate, what we're expecting to see by combining the managers. So we have approximately $330 million allocated with an annual fee of $375,000, which is about 11 basis points, so a nice competitive fee across both managers there. By the way, they're all in a room, so that might be a sensitive issue for them. Alright, page 12 gives you some of the overview of the firms, so a quick highlight of Insight and DFA, and of course they're here to answer their questions, but you'll see that they have long track records doing this, we're getting very experienced personnel doing this, they have deep firm assets, we're not their only client, we don't face issues like that with the firm or with the individual strategies that we're talking about, and so that gives us comfort that these are stable organizations, at least as stable as any we can find out there. Of course, we've certainly seen stable organizations go through turmoil and changes in the past, so that can always happen, but what we're seeing here is looks like 2 pretty stable organizations that we're glad to see and part of our selection criteria. And then page 13 gives a 1-page overview of Insight, and page 14 a 1-page overview of DFA. And so I don't need to go into a lot of detail here, but just as a quick thumbnail, We already discussed Insight being a customized solution, and part of the process here, that you see that third paragraph down, process buy and maintain, a lot of their strategy has to do with buying bonds and letting them mature. And that's pretty nice, because if they mature, you don't care if they trade up or down in the marketplace, because you're going to hold it to maturity. What you care about is whether they default or not. And if they don't default and they continue to pay off, that's a good thing. If they do trade up and down, we can understand that volatility. You look like you have a question.
But you still have to market.
We do.
So you still get those paper gains and losses, and with a possibility, at least, of increasing Fed funds changes, we would see initially some losses.
On the mark-to-market, yes, but because it's buying and maintained, you don't care. Because what they're doing is they're fulfilling the mission of generating the cash flow, be it from the coupon or from the maturity of the bond. If and when they decide to sell a bond, that's exactly when it comes into play, is when they would realize the gain.
But wouldn't we see that on our annual rate
Can I answer that? That's a very good observation, and it's a very correct observation, and it's one of the problems with the actual process, is that the actual process doesn't recognize the fact that we're taking a set of our assets and dedicating them to the liabilities, and so you have a neutral, an offsetting relationship between those assets and those liabilities from a balance sheet perspective, but the actual process doesn't capture that. So while the actual process will discount the value of the assets for the losses, it will do nothing on the liability side and will continue to discount those at the assumed actual rate of return. So you're absolutely right.
How is that going to impact our accounting over time? I mean, could we end up with more revenue than we actually need from our sponsors?
Well, so when we talked about this, I believe it was December, I laid out how we were going to account for this process. And we are going to judge the validity of this process from a balance sheet perspective. So I will take the liabilities at the beginning of the year and take the assets at the beginning of the year, and I will discount them using the spot curve. And then we will look at the assets and liabilities at the end of the year and discount those at the spot curve as well. So from that perspective, it gets exactly to what Ed was saying. It's immune to interest rate risk.
Okay.
And so that's how we will judge the value of this. But from an actuarial perspective, unfortunately, when the interest rates go up and the assets that are out there that are dedicated to these shortfalls go down in value, then the actual process will capture that. But the most important thing is that we all understand that we are a cash flow machine here. We take money in, we do stuff with it, and we put it out. So as long as we are efficiently managing our cash flows, I don't think that that's a very big issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe this is for Rick. Is this Insight is owned by Bank of New York Mellon? Is that our former bank?
It is.
And one of the reasons we left was because of the currency manipulation and, the suggestion that they were cheating their own clients. So my question is, have they made their clients whole?
For the most part, yes, but there were still losses. We incurred losses, I think, of up to $15 million out of the $75 million that we had exposed. It's been a long time, Mike. So I think we ended up losing, what, one-fifth of our value due to the securities lending issues.
So have they made that whole?
No, that was a loss that we took. We got most of it back, but not all of it. But that outcome was built into the contract when we signed it. There was always a potential for losses.
Right, but not for currency manipulation at the expense of clients. So have they been asked to make that whole, or has that even been entered into?
I think that what we should do is wait till Insight gets up there and we can ask them about the relationship between them and Bank of New York Mellon.
Okay.
Page 14 highlights the DFA process, and again, we'll be hearing from DFA. So I won't go into too much description there. We think it's a good fit for the plan, and I think that they're going to go into it in detail. So I'll just leave that page as it stands. And then page 16 has the recommendation, and then we have some performance numbers. So without further ado, I think we can move on to hearing from Insight, unless there are any questions about the overall program design of what we're trying to accomplish.
Just a confirmation. All this money is going to be deployed in United States companies, right?
Yes. I can't think of any.
I believe so. Both of them says U.S. As far as the characteristics.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, yeah. But we can ask them to confirm that.
I think there was some concern that some of this is going towards emerging markets and that sort of thing. I don't think any of this is.
Not in this mandate.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you're seeing in the characteristics?
Yeah.
U.S. short credit?
Yeah. And there was one, something similar on the other company. Mm-hmm. U.S. corporate mm-hmm. fixed income.
Yeah, for Insight.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay. So let's move on to hearing from Insight first. I'll step out of the way. So we have Vicki May and Jerry Berrigan. We're going to have the overview. So I guess introduce yourselves.
Everyone.
Hi.
So I'm Vicki. I'm responsible for the U.S. North American institutional clients for Insight. And this is Jerry Berrigan, and Jerry is head of our U.S. fixed income group. We have little books, and you all have those, that'd be great. Tell me some fun facts about our firm. We can start off with a quick introduction of some of our team, the people who we'll be working hopefully with your plan and your team. Page 3 is a high-level view of a number of faces. Myself and Jerry are on this page, but we're part of a broad team that will be knowing this mandate quite well. And just a quick snapshot of the faces and the roles of each of the teams, including executive sponsorship, Cliff Corso, as well as our client team, of investment team, and our client service team. And biographies for each of these team members are in these materials. I think to kick off, it's important that you know about Insight and our firm, the few key facts about our ownership structure, as I've picked up already, and key facts about our firm. But the most important thing as well is for you to hear what we propose for you. And it's unique and it's differentiated, and we're excited to share that with you, and we're thrilled to be here. So the first couple of slides in this presentation, if you go to page 6, gives you a view of Insight. Insight is an asset management subsidiary. We're owned by Bank of New York Mellon, but we're quite autonomous. We're a very well-established global platform. We were founded in 2002, and BNY Mellon acquired Insight in 2009. We have a large heritage in London, but a significant investment and growth trajectory in the U.S. We've got 86 people in our New York office, and we have a total investment staff of just under 700, including our multiple offices in London, in New York, and some smaller offices in Sydney, Tokyo. We're very proud of the growth trajectory of our firm, and that's illustrated in the diagram. And it's driven by a few key things. Our business was built on custom solutions, which is what we have proposed for you, and Ed providing an overview for. A big focus of our firm and our culture is risk management. Many dimensions to risk management, and each one of those dimensions we have a significant investment in. Our firm's heritage started with a heavy investment in technology, which helps us design and deliver and risk manage custom solutions. You can't do custom solutions without the infrastructure to support it. But at the heart of our investment capability lies an excellent strength in credit, very conservative credit. We'll talk quite a bit about that as a big driver of the portfolio strategy. And our credit management is a big driver between both our active traditional products as well as our custom strategies that we refer to as buy and maintain. Do you have any questions about the firm? The next two slides are just a quick snapshot of our asset mix to show you how the mandate that we're talking about fits in with our overall business. Page 7 shows you two pie charts of our $700 billion in assets. The key points I would make for you are that our traditional active fixed income management is about $144 billion. But we have $500 billion in what we call custom solutions or financial solutions, which are bespoke custom solutions. So over 70% of our business is customized. You can't do that without strong infrastructure. And then the other piece of it is that over 80% of our assets and client base are pensions. So custom, institutional, large pensions is the heart of our business. The next page shows you that if you combine traditional active fixed income with the custom fixed income tools that we use to build these portfolios, we have just about $300 billion in total fixed income assets. So we're a very large fixed income shop. And our U.S. dollar business, which is exactly what this mandate will be, is growing about a base of a little over $30 billion. And the strategy that we're proposing is $30 billion in aggregate. It's a quite well-established strategy, and we're applying it quite uniquely for each one of our clients, and particularly for this mandate. And then from an organizational perspective, you can look at the teams in many different ways. I thought there were just a couple of highlights I would make. First, our business in the U.S. It's a diagram for the leadership of our team in the U.S. is on page 9. We have 86 in our New York office, and of that, 34 are investment professionals out of our total 210 investment professionals. It's a well-established multifunctional team. It's not just a client team. It's not just an investment team. It's a fully formed business. And then page 10 shows you our total fixed income team. And in that chart, it shows you that we're organized by specialty. So we're not a generalist model. We operate as specialists. Jerry leads the U.S. team. We will also be drawing significantly upon the credit research team in our large organization. We have about 100 people dedicated to fixed income globally. And then since the heart of the strategy is credit research, high-grade, investment-grade, corporate, as well as securitized research, I think it's important for you to get just a quick view of the number of people and the resources we have at performing the proprietary research that's behind choosing the names, and that's on page 11. We have a total of 26 corporate credit analysts and 11 credit analysts focusing on the securitized markets.
What is structured credit esoterics?
Structured credit is another name for secured finance or asset-backed finance. Probably best known in the States as asset-backed securities. Securitization of various kinds of receivables. The best known would be a mortgage-backed security, like auto loans, credit card receivables, just about any kind of receivables. The cash flows from those can be securitized and sold into the market. The better known ones are the kind of loans we're all familiar with, mortgage loans, auto loans, credit card borrowing, student loans. But there's lots of different kinds. There's aircraft securitizations, there's whole business securitizations, there's franchise loan securitizations. So once you get beyond sort of the more better known kinds of securitizations, it falls into this bucket of esoterics. Those securities won't have a role in this strategy, but it is something that our firm does.
Yeah, I had no clue what it was.
So I wanted to fly briefly over the organizational introduction so we can get into the investment strategy. Did you have any questions about the firm or the team at all?
What? The question I asked to Rick earlier about our earlier experience with the bank of New York.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're the appropriate people to answer that or not.
Maybe you could talk about the nature of the relationship that you have with Bank of New York Mellon at this time.
So Bank of New York Mellon bought Insight. We were a fully formed business. So they bought us in 2009. We operate quite autonomously. They have a seat on our board, but otherwise our management and our decision making is autonomous.
But they bought you.
They bought us.
They own Insight.
They do, correct. Okay. That we don't have a whole lot of interaction on the banking side with the parent company.
And in fact, is there a separation there, a Chinese wall kind of thing?
Oh, with the bank, certainly, yes. Yeah, so the interactions with the issues that you're raising, we frankly wouldn't have been a part of, and I think it predated the ownership of Insight. So I'm not the person to answer that particular question.
Would you hire or sign a contract with a company that was owned by somebody who had cheated you? Would you sign a contract with somebody, a company that whose owner had cheated you? That's an unfair question. So I don't know how to handle that, Ricky.
Yeah, we would have to defer to whatever took place does predate our association with Bank of New York. We operate as an autonomous entity within the Bank of New York family of boutique investment firms. We certainly can't represent that we would be able to make whole for anything that the bank did. The legal framework of our ownership structure wouldn't account for it. But again,
I know it's not your question, so I just caught that when I saw the ownership.
They're holding the money, Bank of New York Mellon.
We actually don't use Bank of New York Mellon for our back office. We use Northern Trust.
Okay.
which is a statement of our autonomy.
Does the Bank of New York Mellon have any input into the decision-making process at Insight?
Not from an investment perspective, by no means, no.
Would the agreement between Stanislaw County and Insight be with Insight?
One of the Insight entities, correct.
But they do provide some guarantees, Bank of New York, as far as Insight as a company, if it were to dissolve.
They have a balance sheet that they own us, but there's not a there's no capital guarantees of the business. It's not a
If we had to sue somebody, who would we sue? You or Bank of New York?
Why don't we hear the presentation? We'll discuss this when they're done.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm good with that.
The contract here.
Well, don't have action until they're done.
But Insight does not, would not have custody at any point in any of the funds.
And I would also point out that, this has got to go through legal first. And so these are items that we can pair it out, and if we want to add any additional protection language or whatever that covers stands there, we can do that at that time. So why don't we get on with the presentation?
Sure. If there aren't any other questions, I was going to pick up on page 13, actually, talking specifically about the investment solution that's being considered. Ed did a very nice job of summarizing the solution. I understand that there was a very fulsome vetting of the concept at the October meeting. So I won't spend any time on that. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have on this kind of solution as a concept, but I think the more important discussion and what I would like to leave you with is our ability to deliver what we think are the key success factors to executing that strategy. So certainly, the solution, as has been discussed, is a liability-aware solution. What does that mean? It means the investments are specifically structured and assembled to meet the liability stream with as much certainty as possible. We think of it as a paired process. Those success factors that I referred to are the process for selecting the individual investments and separately aggregating those into the optimal portfolio. So the credit process we call buy and maintain. It's an investment strategy that, as I pointed out, is a little bit different than what you may be used to in terms of your asset managers managing on a total rate of return basis versus a benchmark. Buy and maintain strategy is really designed with a buy to hold perspective. The intention is to invest in certain kinds of companies and certain kinds of securities, and then hold those to maturity. And the cash flows that come off of those investments are specifically timed to meet the liability payments. That does a number of things. It provides certainty of cash flows, benefit shortfall payments in this case, for a specified period of time. From that perspective, it provides a very nice complement to other strategies that have a different focus for the higher return target. It provides a degree of immunization from market forces. talked about the fact that changes in market rates will affect the valuation of the assets, but those same market forces affect the valuation of liabilities, and those losses that would be reported, unrealized losses on the asset side, would not be realized because there would be no need to sell any securities prior to their maturity. And so over time, those unrealized losses, as the bonds approach maturity, amortize basically down to zero. Bonds mature, and the cash flows are used to make the required payments. It's specifically designed to be a lower turnover strategy. One of the things that has gone on in the marketplace, certainly since the 2006 to 2008 experiences, capital markets have changed in terms of the liquidity that they offer and the ability to sell securities when you want to or need to. And one of the things that we found is it tends to be an unfriendly correlation between when you want to sell bonds and when liquidity is available in the market. So strategies that don't necessarily rely on frequent turnover of portfolio provide a little bit more certainty in terms of outcome, which we think is important. And it also offers an attractive spread when we think about the discount curves that Rick talked about. Those are benchmark government curves, but the investment securities are by and large investment grade corporate securities that offer a yield spread over that. So there's still the opportunity and the expectation of earning an attractive yield over those benchmark spreads. So it has a lot of the advantages of a traditional investment strategy, but it's specifically designed to overcome some of the shortcomings and really be very customizable to an investment challenge like the one we're talking about here. So anyway, without any further ado, just a little bit more on the buy and maintain strategy. It's, as I said, designed to give you structural exposure to the credit markets and earn my spread that we talked about. But to overcome some of the shortcomings of passive investing. People hear buy and maintain, they think buy and hold, they think of indexing and other passive investment strategies. Some of the shortcomings of a strategy like that, one of the biggest is that the composition of most benchmark indices is determined by the debt outstandings of the component companies. So the bigger a company is, the more money it borrows, the bigger component of an index is. So if you want to mirror that, what you're really doing is you're lending the most money in your portfolio to the companies that are most indebted to the market. And they may or may not be the best companies from a rating perspective or from a rating stability perspective. We have a specific methodology for identifying companies. We take a longer-term view for our buy and maintain mandates. Pay less attention to the potential performance of those issuers over a one-month, one-quarter, even a one-year time frame, and think more about will they be able to pay their debts when they come due, because that's what this portfolio is designed to do. So we invest for the longer term. We also try and be thoughtful about the kinds of companies that we invest at different parts of the maturity curve. Company like Apple is a good example. It's a company that has about $87 billion in debt, about $200 billion in cash. certainly very capable of meeting its obligations in the near term. We're comfortable investing in a company like that in a strategy like this for up to 5 years. It's very difficult to imagine what a company like Apple is going to look like in 10 years or 30 years and what their business model is going to be. We're not comfortable in a strategy like this, investing in a company like that for longer maturities. Alternatively, a regulated industry like utility that sells first mortgage bonds, they're actually backed by the hard assets of that company. It's much easier to get comfortable investing longer term in a company like that. So depending on the tenor of the mandate, that really drives the security selection in a mandate like this. And again, you know, the principles of diversification apply here as they do in every portfolio. You don't want to be investing purely to reflect an index or a year or one in a portfolio look like that. When companies combine, you think about Time Warner, AT&T, if that merger goes through, that combined company will have about 4% of the debt outstanding in the corporate index. Not comfortable taking that much exposure to any one company. We typically limit individual security holdings to a percent, 1.5% of the overall portfolio. Sector like financials, that can be up to 30 or 40% of certain credit indices. We'll limit this exposure to any individual sector to 25% of the overall portfolio. So the basic principles of diversification apply here as well.
Pardon me.
Sure.
So you were talking about you wouldn't be comfortable with certain firms, corporates, going longer than just a few years, but utilities you would. Do you make exceptions to that? I mean, is that a broad brush, and when you dial it down, it's actually a company by company, or are those parameters that you actually set? I'm thinking Disney 100-year bonds, and I'm thinking the Washington Power Munis that went bankrupt. So, I mean, are there exceptions, or are those broad parameters, or?
Well, the Washington Public Power Whoops bonds.
Yes. Yes.
We're not first mortgage bonds. They weren't backed by, specifically by the RS of the company. 100-year Disney bonds certainly would never turn up in a portfolio like this. I would characterize a company like Disney as falling into that bucket. It's just too hard to predict. I don't claim to know what's going to be going on 100 years.
So those are general parameters, and then you dial it down from there, but they are pretty strong parameters.
They're pretty strong guiding principles, but you make an excellent point. It is on an issuer-by-issuer basis that individual parameters are set, and we will set tenors for individual credits as well. It's not binary. It's not different.
Okay.
Apple, again, is an example. We will invest up to five.
You don't have some algorithm that you're running. You actually...
No.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
And we think that there's actually value to be added from credit process like that. If you turn to page 15, a little bit of proof of concept. You compare the history of defaults in our buy and maintain portfolios to that of the investment grade index using Moody's statistics over the last 20 years. You compare defaults in our portfolio compared to 73 over a comparable time period for the overall investment grade universe according to Moody's statistics. So, if you do the credit work and get that right, you can do a much better job of the market at large. We think that's another very strong advantage over typical passive investing and pure indexing strategies. And we're taking that careful security selection and credit identification process and combining that with and here's where we get into algorithms, a way to distill all this data and figure out what the best combination of securities is a fairly daunting task. It's not something that's intuitively obvious when you're talking about the universe. When we started this example, it included well over 1,000 securities. We're talking about liability payments that are monthly for 4 or 6 years. And we're talking about constraints that we think are sensible and that we want to make sure we agree on with you all that will guide the overall profile of this portfolio. And when you take all of those different ingredients, you really need fairly robust computational ability to be able to figure out which combination of those securities is optimal in terms of getting the greatest yield for a specified level of risk. And we have a model like that. It's part of an overall optimization process that's characterized on page 16 here. And if you think about, you know, starting at the upper left, what was the challenge? Well, helping you all meet your benefit shortfall payments for a defined period, 6 years. So we chart those out. That becomes a couple of things. It becomes the cash flow match that we are solving for in the optimization exercise. And it also becomes the benchmark for the resulting asset portfolio. The center of the page on the top, the investable universe. A bit of a diagram to describe how we distill all of those issuers out there and how we sort of triage the overall opportunity set in terms of identifying credits, companies that we're comfortable investing in, and the subset of that group that we think are appropriate for buy and maintain strategies like this one. And then on the top right, the portfolio constraints, the guidelines, but not just the outer limits of the approved investment guidelines, the preferred risk of the client. One of the things I think a lot of investors learn the hard way is even within fairly well-defined investment guidelines, you create a lot of mischief if you're constantly running at the outer margins of all of the guidelines in the portfolio. So, we put a lot of effort into really trying to understand what the ask is, what the overall risk tolerance of the client is, because if you know if we deliver the right outcome, but we offer a wild ride on the way, or take too much risk doing it, we haven't done our job well. The result of that, as you see at the bottom of the page, is a portfolio of asset cash flows versus the modeled liability stream. And the result is a very tight cash flow match between the assets and the liabilities. Again, preventing the need to sell any securities into a potentially illiquid market.
Just to interject something to refresh the board's memory, the reason you've got those spikes below zero is because we have two or three times a year when we get three payrolls in from our plan sponsors. And so we don't have a shortfall two or three times a year. That's what the spike's below zero. Otherwise, if not, then it'd be a much straighter line, a positive number all the way across.
So I'm on page 16. That's sort of an idealized cash flow match of a portfolio that's designed to specifically meet every dollar of liability payment perfectly, with no reinvestment risk, no money coming in any sooner than it's actually needed. We actually relaxed that constraint in a couple of scenarios, and it was one that I think we would recommend. If you look at page 17, you'll see a similar cash flow graph on the upper right, but you see instances where there's more asset cash flow coming in a given period than there is going out in that period, and those cash flows are used to make payments in subsequent months. One of the interesting quirks of an optimization like this is if you free up the constraints a little bit, you can actually add yield to the portfolio because the optimization process has the freedom to select better bonds, cheaper bonds, better credits at different parts of the curve without being artificially constrained to exactly having to match your cash flow. The graph below that shows the cumulative payments. And I think an important thing to observe there is the solid green line is the cumulative liabilities. The olive green shading under it is the accumulated asset cash flows. You'll notice that at certain times there's more cash flow coming in than is required, but at no time is there less cash flow coming in. There's never a negative cash flow deficit. There's no daylight between under that solid green line, which is important. So the only constraint that's been relaxed is the one that allows for a certain amount of overinvestment, potentially to take advantage of a higher interest rate environment should it materialize. But the success of the strategy doesn't depend on it, and it does provide certainty of cash being there when And that's really all I had in terms of sort of framing out how we think about a mandate like this, how we get chosen as your investment advisor to deliver on that part of the portfolio, and how we view it as kind of a new complement to a different strategy, duration match, but is a little bit more free to trade and for potentially a higher rate of return in the market. So, with that, any questions you have? Or?
So there are no additional fees when you when you're providing the matching cash flows like just in time.
No.
That your fees is already in the.
Members, is there? Darren just stepped out for a second, but any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So we have Ted Simpson and David Plecka from Dimension Fund Advisors. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that it's kind of atypical to have managers present while each other's in the room, but we're actually asking them to work together on this mandate, so we think it's good for them to hear what each other's presentations are. And they'll certainly be working together on behalf of Spencera going forward, which we would hope to assume. And so we put that on, turn it over to something like that.
I do want to start off by introducing myself, Ted Simpson. I'm a relationship manager with the bulk of California-based institutional clients. Obviously, the team that does that within the institutional services group across the western portion of the United States. And I recognize many of your faces from South Sacred Leagues, and look forward to seeing you as well. To my left here, Dave Plecka, who is the head of our fixed income portfolio management team. I've been with Dimension just a little over 15 years, Dave. 2 dozen years.
Still lucky.
And with that, I do want to thank you very much for the opportunity to come and talk to you about Dimensional's ability to provide a U.S. short credit solution to your to work with Insight to provide those needs for your the liquidity portion of your portfolio. I'll start out by just mentioning that Dimensional does have a somewhat differentiated investment philosophy view of the world in that, in a nutshell, we're a firm that's really looking to try to beat the markets for you, but to do so without outguessing the market. And so Dave will get into more details in terms of what that really means. But at a high level, we are looking not to try to predict markets, interest rates, individual securities, mispricings, but instead use information that's known and observable, things like current prices and yields, to position the portfolio towards characteristics that rigorous empirical academic research has shown will help the portfolio outperform over time, and to do so in a very process-driven, structured approach with very patient and flexible implementation, which helps save costs there as well. In terms of Dimensional as a firm, we are a very stable and successful firm. Very proud to see continued client growth over recent years, over recent decades. We are privately held by a broad number of employees, as well as a handful of smaller positions by friends of the firm. If you look on page 5, you can see some of the facts and figures about the firm. We are founded back in the early 1980s. We do provide strategies across essentially long-only equity, fixed income, and some kind of real assets, REITs, commodities. And our first strategy was in U.S. microcap equity, but our second strategy in 1983 was in fixed income. So a long history in fixed income of our now over $450 billion in assets, just under $100 billion of that is in our fixed income strategies. We do have up over 100, over 1,000 employees globally. The bulk of those are in our Austin headquarters, which has been our headquarters for the last 8 years or so. Prior to that, Santa Monica, where Dave and I are from, was our headquarters, and our newest U.S. presence is in Charlotte. But then not as germane to this strategy, since our understanding is you like to see all U.S. Securities, but we do have offices around the globe, as you can see. And then the last thing that I'd like to touch on before turning it over to Dave is our deep connection with the academic community. If you look on page 6, you can see some of the academics, especially on the left side of this page, at the top of that column, and at the bottom are those who are very involved with dimensional, not just as names of a figurehead, but very involved with us on a daily or weekly or monthly basis. Gene Fama and Ken French, specifically, folks like Rick, who had to say for their CFA, probably recognize some of those names and heard some of the things they had to study about him. But and then also those at the bottom, another Nobel Prize winner, Bob Merton. And then some in the middle on the left are more or less involved, I guess, what we'd be proposing for you in terms of the separate account strategy, but on our mutual fund boards as well. But certainly a lot. But very importantly as well is the PhDs we have on the right-hand side of this page, because they are internal colleagues who work very closely with these academics to make sure that we're able to bring the best and brightest of their thinking into solutions for our clients, and really to make that almost an academic feedback group, so we can present these academics with the opportunity to think about issues the clients think you have, and then to bring the thinking to your issues. So if there's, I certainly have more I can tell you about the firm, but in the interest of time, unless there's any further questions, I'm going to turn it over to Dave to talk a little bit more about the last implementation process that I've
described. Okay, so if you turn to page 8, we start out with just for you, sort of a snapshot of bar chart, pie chart on our fixing capabilities. And of course, you look now, 33 years into it, you see a very well developed set of strategies, domestic and global, short, intermediate, and long. It didn't start out that way. Of course, that was a long 33-year build to get to that point. Like Ted had mentioned, our first strategy we launched in 1983, and the very first one we did was a very, very short term, we call ultra short, very, very high credit quality portfolio. That portfolio, by the way, is still running to this day, so we got off the ground in a good way. But it was probably, that strategy was probably the lowest risk portfolio you could run outside of the money market fund, but that's where we started. And the process over the next 3 years was very slow but steady, progression a little bit farther, incrementally out the yield curve and down the credit spectrum. If you look at what we are now, basically I describe us as investment grade, government and corporate bond, domestic and developed market international. So those are what we do. Government and corporate bonds around the developed world. If you look on page 9, which is a snapshot of the team, I joined in 1989. So this is the first 6 years in the fixed income development, but I have seen the last 27. And of course, it's very much a privilege for me to be ahead of this team, an outstanding group of men and women. You can see long 10 years in the industry and at Dimensional as well. Just a couple of things I would point out for, again, this is going to be a domestic mandate, but it is a globally diversified team because we do run global strategies and supporting us that we have sort of boots on the ground in the markets that we're trading in. So we are in London and Sydney and Tokyo as well. Also, a significant emphasis on trading. You see on the right, these traders are full-time traders. So all they do is fixed income trading, portfolio managers. We'll submit orders to them. We give them a great degree of flexibility. They're not required to do any trade. We give them the ability to walk away from any trade. That's probably the most important bargaining chip that we can give them. They're true professionals. We trust their judgment. If they say the levels I'm getting don't look good to me, I recommend that we we pass on this one. We take that recommendation and we try to find them a substitute. Now, that's all very, very well and good, but probably those bullet points off to the right are the most important. Those are the oversight committees, the governance committees, that ultimately, on the desk, what we do is implement. We implement the strategies that are designed given to us by these committees. I'm a member of both the Investment Policy Committee and the Investment Committee. Just briefly, Investment Policy Committee works on issues that we might study for a year. These are not, should we buy this bond or sell this bond? It's there are issues that go on the equity side. It might be, you know, does the profitability of the company matter? You know, that type of thing. And filled with researchers, including professors Fong and French and Morton and others. And, you know, the way researchers work, you answer one question, they come back with two more. You answer those two, they come back with four more. So these take the, we work on topics for a long time. Investment committee meets twice a month. That's where ultimately policy is set. We have a long-term expression that we've used forever. There's no policy on the desk. No policy is made on the trading desk. We may recommend changes to a portfolio. Maybe we should bump our limit in Japanese bonds in a global portfolio from 15 to 20%. We don't have the authority to make that decision on the desk. We go to the investment committee, seek their approval. If the investment committee gives the approval, it would go from there to the compliance group. The compliance group would write that into the code, that what we're allowed to do, and we move on from there. And of course, a very, very well-developed research staff that is, of course, a huge asset to all of us, both on the PM and trading desk as well. So moving on to the philosophy, starting on page 11, just sort of a 30,000-foot view on fixed income markets in general. We ask, first, what are the main drivers of returns in fixed income? And to us, it's a very, very straightforward proposition. The main drivers, what explains most variation in bond returns, are these two dimensions, as we call them, term and credit. Term being how long is the maturity of the bond, or the duration of the bond. Credit, what is the quality, or the essentially the probability of default from the issuer. We talk about, you know, what it takes to rise to the level of being called a dimension, a dimensional fund. Of course, we don't throw that term around loosely. So we have some parameters here. Sensible, of course, we'd say if you look at longer term bonds, we do observe higher average returns on longer term bonds than we do on intermediate bonds, which have higher average returns than short term bonds. On credit, you know, we see higher average returns on intermediate bonds than we would on single A bonds or double. Or triple. Those make sense to us, that investors, that you see higher average returns, but we know that they don't come for free. Investors must bear more risk in order to pursue those returns. It's sensible that ultimately investors would demand higher returns to move farther up the curve or lower down the credit spectrum. When we talk about persistence, we can see them through all time periods, not every quarter or every year, but we have solid data going back to the mid-20s. We can see the persistence of these premiums. We talk about pervasiveness. We study markets around the world. We see the same things, that around the world, on average, intermediate bonds have higher returns than short, or triple B bonds have higher returns. So we view these as the main drivers of return. Our strategy ultimately is to deliver those premiums. That's what we set out to do. We're going to do that in a very, very highly diversified way, systematic way, not counting on us finding mispriced securities in the marketplace. Our view is that on average markets are quite good at pricing securities. If you're familiar with the work of Professor Eugene Fong, you know, that's sort of the centerpiece of his career's work, which he was awarded a Nobel Prize. But ultimately we're saying that we don't have to find mispriced securities. On average we think they're properly priced, but in the end those premiums are there for the taking if you systematically know how to pursue those premiums. On page 12, I'll first talk about term. It's not hard to, you simply have to observe returns to see, yeah, the long-term bonds had higher average returns than intermediate, and intermediate had higher average returns than short. That alone wasn't going to get Fama a Nobel Prize. Fama's work really started when he began in fixed income, studying about how those premiums have been paid. Is there something we could say about those premiums or the expected premium? Are they constant through time, or do they vary through time? The expected premium, or the forward-looking expected premium. and through a whole series of research on markets and market pricing, FAMO concluded that there is something that you could say about the expected term premium. On the top panel on page 12, we show a yield curve, and in this case, an upwardly sloped yield curve. That's the more normal shape that you normally see. Bond yields go up as you go farther out in maturity. But they're not always that way. There's no law of physics that says that the yield curve must be upwardly sloped. There are times where we see flat yield curves, where yields on two-year bonds and yields on five-year bonds or 10-year bonds are all about the same. And there are other times, also we show in the bottom panel, where the curve is actually downwardly sloped, where the yield on a five-year bond will be lower than the yield on a two-year bond. In the last 33 years, we've been through five of those periods of inverted curves. Our last one was in 2007, so we're actually in quite a long stretch of consistently upwardly sloped curves. But FAMO was basically studying about the expected premium based on curve shape. And what he found, not only theoretically, but also empirically, he found that on average, premiums are higher during periods of upwardly sloped curves. Premiums are lower in flat or inverted curves. So in other words, you just sort of let your eyeball do the work. If you extend out an upwardly sloped curve, you're buying bonds with higher yields as you move farther out. And on average, you are rewarded with higher returns for doing so. But if you consider a flat yield curve, as you extend out, you're getting no additional yield. You're basically, by definition, a flat curve. You're getting the same yield. We would argue that you have no expectation for a rate of return, and historically you have not gotten one. And in fact, in an inverted curve, as you extend out, you are now accepting lower yields for more term risk, and we would argue you should have no expectation for a premium. Our strategy basically says we should take term risk when we anticipate a reward or a premium for doing so. We will extend out in upwardly sloped curves. But in flat or inverted curves, we're not willing to take that same term risk without any expectation for a premium. So in our short-term strategies, let's say strategies that have a three-year maximum duration, well, for the last 7 years, we would have been very, very close to our three-year maximum. But if the curve flattened or inverted, you would see that we would be shortening on that type of trade. And what FAMA showed was that strategies that are sensitive to the expected premium, that vary the amount of risk they take as a function of the expected premium, will have higher returns than strategies that are just static. You just pick a point and stay there regardless of the expected premium. On credit, very similar story about expected credit premiums. FAMA found that they do vary and they are related to the credit spread. Credit spreads are observable in today's market. We can look at yields on corporate bonds today. We can look at the yield on treasury bonds. We can subtract one from the other and see the spread. And you can see that spread ebbs and flows through time. Sometimes spreads are wide and sometimes they're narrow. And FAMA was able to relate today's observable spread to subsequent realized credit premium. So on average, when credit spreads are wide, you expect a larger credit premium for taking credit risk in those periods. When credit spreads are narrow, when the yield on corporate bonds is just slightly above the yield on the government bonds, we expect a smaller premium. The corporate bonds, on average, are going to pay a smaller premium relative to government bonds than they would when spreads are wide. So we will vary the amount of credit we take accordingly. We'll tilt more, if we're investment grade, will tilt more in the direction of the single A's and triple B's in periods when credit spreads are relatively wide. We'll tilt more in the direction of the AAA and AA when credit spreads are relatively narrow. And there's just a quick cheat sheet on page 14 that sort of summarizes four-station nature, periods of upwardly sloped curves, periods of flat and inverted curves, periods of relatively wide credit spreads versus periods of relatively narrow credit spreads, and basically how our strategies react. So it's a very transparent approach. The academic research has all been in the public domain since FAMA published it going back literally from 1976. But even this little cheat sheet should allow almost anyone to know, even before meeting with us, what will our portfolios look like. If you just say, if somebody show me what their yield curve looks like, if you see it's upwardly sloped, you'd know we'd be near our upper limit. If you had a look at credit spreads, if you saw that they were relatively wide, you'd see us more tilted towards the single A's and triple B's. So there should be no surprises in what the portfolio looks like. And as far as implementing it, I think this is a key point that, developing strategies that work on paper is great, but if you can't make them work in practice, then they're basically worthless. And I think in the end, that almost defines what dimensional fundraising systems has been about. And it's been David Booth, our founder, who was a research assistant of Fama's back at the University of Chicago. You may recognize the Booth name. The business school is now called Chicago Booth because of a very, very generous gift David made to the school. But Booth basically was that link between the academic research and the markets, and those two have worked together sort of as first as a research assistant, but now sort of as an academic mentor for the last 35 years. What can you actually get done in the marketplace, and what is the academic research showing? So implementing for us is all about A, controlling the risk, and B, controlling the costs. So when we talk about implementing and pursuing these premiums, the credit premium, the term premium, we want to do it in a highly, highly diversified way. And we're trying to get systematic exposure to the premiums. And that actually creates, we allow it to create quite a bit of flexibility when it comes to implementation. So we're going to form a highly diversified portfolios, not concentrated in 30 issuers or 50 issuers or 100 issuers, but pushing more towards 200 issuers or beyond if we can. Each issuer represents a tiny fraction of the portfolio. We will tilt the portfolio depending on spreads, where we want to go. But when it comes time to transacting, then we give our traders quite a bit of flexibility. So we can rank order the securities from highest expected return to lowest expected return. In general, we're trying to maximize expected returns subject to the constraints that the guidelines and the investment committee gave us. But when we go to the trader, we give them many opportunities to execute a trade. So we talk about being patient and being flexible on both time and on quantity. So our senior trader would say that about a third of the orders that go from the PM desk to the trading desk, about a third don't get done. About a third get done in a partial amount. Give an order for 2 million. He says, look, I can get you a very good level on 1 million. We say, do the 1 million, cancel the balance. And about a third get done in full. So there is quite a bit of flexibility. Depending on what gets done, if you move from left to the right on the chart on page 16, we that goes into the portfolio. We reassess every single day. Is there a way we can increase the expected return of the portfolio? On page 17, we do a quick look at transactions costs. I think that this is a very, very important feedback loop to us. Is a systematic transaction cost analysis. This analysis was not possible prior to 2002. First half of my career, we couldn't do something like this. In 2002, the markets changed significantly. The transparency, post-trade transparency, increased significantly with the adoption of what's known as the TRACE database. Think of TRACE as the bond market's ticker tape. The equity markets, we take ticker tapes for granted. Go to Times Square in New York, you see it everywhere you look. There's stock prices running across the tape. Basically, those are transactions. The equity markets figured out 150 years ago when a stock trades. We should disseminate the information, the price, and the amount. That didn't catch up to the bond market until the 21st century, until 2002. But now we can see actual transactions within, now in the current evolution, we can, it's within a 15-minute lag. But we could essentially, on a semi-real-time basis, see transactions. So we could compare our transactions against transactions in the exact same security. And in this example we're showing on page 17, the adjacent trades, the trade just prior to us, the trade just after us. How did we do? The blue diamond is us, the green dot is the trade. This is expressed in price, so we're trying to buy at lower prices. The trades happening just adjacent to us are happening at higher prices, so we're buying at a lower price than the trades in the near vicinity. Our sells were able to sell at higher prices. This is driven mostly by the patience and flexibility that we have, that we give the traders. If every order that goes from a PM to a trader has to get done, The other side eventually figures that out. They eventually figure out, yeah, the guy's playing hardball, but he'll cave because he always does. He has to do the trade. Giving the trader that ability to walk away from a trade is the most powerful position you can put a trader in. And in the end, if the trader says, I think we should walk from this one, we hold portfolios with hundreds of securities, there can be plenty of substitutes. Okay, that one didn't work, I'll get you a substitute. So we are patient on both time and quantity. And then just finally on page 18, probably just the most important page of the presentation is about the risk controls. So the type of risk controls that we have in place, probably the most powerful risk control strategy that anyone would have is diversification. By not concentrating your investments in a handful of names, but spreading it out over a couple hundred names, that makes any individual issuer a very, very tiny component. The average weight per issuer is going to be a fraction of of 1%. We've always put emphasis on liquidity. Some of the things that we talked about, investment grade, government, corporate bond, and developed markets, even our global strategies, which I think people's instinct is to say, well, that must be less liquid. We maintain the same liquidity standards on the global standard, on the global strategies as well. These strategies are not only designed ultimately, and approved by an investment committee, but like I had mentioned earlier, the investment committee then takes those guidelines and hands them over to our compliance group. Our compliance group is a completely independent group. They write the rules into our order management system. No one in my group, myself included, none of us have added privileges over those rules. They write them, and we'll do an independent compliance check every single night on every single portfolio and report upstream if there were to be any compliance issues. The nice little feature, of course, is that we're allowed to, we can run a so-called pre-trade compliance on every trade that we propose. So every trade that we do before we do, we would run it through what's known as a pre-trade compliance, which basically asks the question, if I do this trade, will the portfolio stay in compliance? And we can see. So the incidence of compliance errors are extremely, extremely low because we will have checked every trade. Literally, an order cannot move from the portfolio manager to the trader without being run through that pre-trade compliance check. So that's the types of software that we have as far as managing risk control analytics. We showed briefly here on the right, systems like Barclays Point and Bloomberg that allow us the full risk analytics. So with that, I will stop now and see if there are any questions.
The last thing I'll just point out besides thank you is that there is a strategy summary here, which is an example of a U.S. short credit. I will point out that the deposit there includes the non-U.S. exposure, which is hedged. If we are given the opportunity to work with you, we would work with Greg and the Paris to kind of put together the parameters for your portfolio, which we understand would not include that, so just to highlight that. And then it would all be, as Dave said, kind of put through set up in our compliance system, so we want just the way you want it. Yeah, thank you. Hopefully, you'll see that this is a nice complementary approach to other. Please, sir.
I do have a couple of questions. Sorry. So this probably is directed more towards Dave. So it sounds like there's probably not a lot of portfolio turnover in this strategy.
We're not averse to selling a security.
Right.
It's not. There's no guideline that says only as a last resort should you sell a security. We would look to sell a security if we can increase the expected return of the portfolio net of the cost involved in that by doing that trade. So as an example, it's just a simple example. Let's say the portfolio maximum duration allowed is 3, and we're very near our limit, and we're at 2.95. Every day that passes, every security gets one day shorter. So eventually, for lack of doing anything, assuming there's no bonds ensuring that we're reinvesting, everything's getting a little shorter. So now we find ourselves with the ability to actually increase the duration and still stay within our guidelines. Can we sell a shorter bond and extend it? If the curve's upwardly sloped, we would look to do what we call an extension trade. Can I sell a shorter bond and buy a longer bond if the curve's upwardly sloped? That would lead me to a higher expected return. It'll bump up the duration a little bit, but if it's still within guidelines, we would look to do that. So it's not a strategy that says try to avoid trading, but we are cognizant every expected return. When we do that analysis, the expected return, if I bought that bond versus the expected return, if I hold on to the bond I've got, it's all done net of transactions cost. And only if the trade makes sense after the cost of transacting would we do it. That means it's trades like selling a 25-month bond to buy a 26-month bond generally doesn't make sense because the cost of doing the trade overwhelms the benefit of moving it out 1 month. The curve is not that different over a 1 month increment. But we will have trades, but they're done to increase expected return.
In the event, in the event of a credit event, would you just automatically get rid of that security? Or
what we do is every single security in every portfolio is assigned what we call an internal rating. We use this trace data. We look for where the market is pricing that security. And you will find cases where the market prices it for belies its credit rating. So that might have a single A rating. You might see it, the way the market is pricing it, it's trading like a BBB. So we view that as saying the reason the market's pricing it like a BBB is it's because it actually is a BBB. The rating agencies just haven't caught up yet to the market. So in cases where we will look at bonds, if they start trading like a BB, for example, they still might have an investment grade rating. So on the surface, it might look like, well, everything's fine. It's still investment grade. If the market is pricing it like a BB, we will internally mark it as a BB, and it becomes a sell candidate debt. So we don't wait until the downgrade, we let the market, basically say the market is pricing in that risk, abnormally spread bonds with abnormally wide credit spreads. We view they're there for a reason. Those are the market's telling you these are very risky securities. If they no longer fit the characteristics of investment grade, we'll sell it then.
I see. Okay. And one other question. This one probably directed. Well, it is directed to Ted. Not probably. I noticed on the placement agent disclosure that it's Edward Simpson. So I've always called you Ted, so I'm assuming you are Edward, right?
I'm both. All right. Not as common in America as it is in places like Britain and Australia, but my nickname from Edward is Ted.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
That's all I have.
Yeah, and the very last thing I was going to mention, I've been sending these invites to Rick over the years, but now certainly to the extent that you guys might have a hopefully a little bit more interest in dimensional. One of the things we love to do as well is to provide educational forums to any of the institutional community. But we have one coming up in March in San Francisco at lunch, and then a full kind of a two-day event down in Texas in late April, where both Fama and French will be presenting. So we'd love to have those of you who enjoy these things are typical. There's no quizzes at the end, you know what you're going to get when you come to our portfolios or our presentations. But if any of you enjoy that kind of academic presentations, we'd love to have you. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Let's turn it back over to Ed.
Yeah.
So you heard about managers now, and we saw the proposal that's written out, and I think a couple of the key things that really struck us in terms of the on-site due diligence when we went through is A, competitive fees, B, transparency, that as you heard from each of the managers, you have a pretty good, thorough understanding of what they do. They showed us in even more detail in person what they do and had some other visual aids and such, so we got a lot of comfort with that. And see a good performance track record, the organizational stability, the strategies themselves, give us a lot of comfort. So.
And I want to say that regarding Insight, when we were there, I guess they're more in my wheelhouse in terms of how I was, how my career progressed in the actual world. And they were very, very much in tune with the processes that I've learned through my academic career and my resulting career as an actuary. And I really think they had our process nailed. I came out of that meeting really feeling that way. So I have confidence on the liquidity and managing the shortfalls that they really know what we're doing here.
Ed, do you have anything else?
Well, then, if there are questions.
Any questions?
Just one question. So what's the exact nature of the relationship between the two firms here today? Will there be a movement of funds between them as needed, or is this distinct as far as the fund management piece of it?
So that is a great question and a key part of why we ask staff to be heavily involved in this, because that is key to managing the FFP. So maybe, Rick, I'd ask you to take that question.
So one of the things that we asked the products manager, yes, I keep getting those two, good, was that one of the things we said that we wanted was that the relationship of the investments, the duration of the investments, should have some bearing on our liabilities beyond 6 years. So when they crafted their solution, they crafted a solution that had our cash flows in mind beyond the 6 years. And I think that from our perspective, we our first place that we would look at the end of the year to replenish that sixth year cash flow that's going to be needed to be replenished each year will come from the products manager. And at the end of each year, depending on how interest rates move during the year, how the equity markets perform and the rest of our portfolio performs, we may come to you and say we want to ensure 9 years of shortfalls instead of just 6 years. Or we may come to you and say, we instead of insuring shortfalls, we want to start insuring the pure benefit payments, something like that. So in those cases and in those potential solutions, we most likely would look towards the product manager for the replenishment or additional cash flows that we would want to put into this program. So they were very much, yes, it very much is a part of the overall solution.
And operationally, I think there's also the component of the cash flow management, which involves the contributions, the payments, all of that coordination with the managers. And by and large, that will more heavily involve Insight, and EFA is less involved in that cash flow portion.
But we will look to DFA first. But there's always the possibility that we've got a lot of money sitting around from distributions from our alternatives too. And it may happen, you know, 3 weeks before we go to replenish this bucket. So I'm not going to say for sure that we're going to be tapping the products manager for that money, but I think that's the intent here and the idea.
So when does the $330 million get transferred, and who is it transferred from?
So we're recommending approximately $100 million to Insight. That covers the shortfalls,
right,
the present value of our shortfalls. And then, what, $230 million to the products manager. I'll let you talk about when you think that would occur, timing-wise.
And who's it come from?
So this is part of the phase one implementation. When we talk about the implementation plan, there are three phases to that.
Right.
This would be part of phase one. And it would be coordinated with the funding of the U.S. Treasury mandate that we selected, I believe, in November. Maybe it's October. And the risk parity manager, which we haven't even started having that discussion yet. So we anticipated that that would happen in March. I can see it March or April sometime, depending on how fast we move to risk parity search. All three of those would be coordinated at once, and we would do a plan-wide rebalancing, so we bring everything back to target using the new targets. So it's hard to say where it's coming from, where it's going to, because it would be based on market values at that time.
Okay, so it's not happened yet.
It's not happened yet.
Okay.
But for the most part, it would be coming out of fixed income already, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
So you got to look around where there's a chunk big enough for $330 million to come out of.
So it would
5% of it might be the rebalancing on the domestic equities.
Domestic equities would definitely be a source. They've done well and they are overweight now.
Mm-hmm.
Fixed income, so our existing core plus managers, those would be rebalanced out.
Well, is there a likelihood or a possibility that, you know, we agree to something here today or in the near future, and then the markets take off and domestics are doing tremendous because of President Trump, and we don't want to sell them? Are we obliged to make the transfer anyway?
No. You're not. What we would do is, as a result of today's action, we would get the contracts in place, so start working on the contracting language, get that process in place. We would expect to bring back to you in February or March our Verisys updated capital market assumptions, at which time we review the FFP six-year asset allocation and make sure we're still on target with that. That would give us the updated numbers to implement. So we have a couple checkpoints before we actually pull the plug. And then there would be the final rebalancing analysis that we present to you and say, and here are the dollar amounts that we intend to move. And that would be another checkpoint. So we have a couple intermediate steps before we do that. We also have ranges around our asset allocation too. So we have some tactical movement and freedom. So we're trying to set the strategic vision for the next 10 years, recognizing that today might look a little bit different, and so we might want to account for that.
Okay.
If we pull the plug at any time based on market changes, would there be any cost to us based on when we pulled the plug?
Well, there's always transaction costs, sure. Is that what you mean, or do you think you have something else?
Well, as Mike was talking, if we decided market's going running well, if we decide not to go with this, and along these phases, a certain amount of work has been done with everybody, contracts and different things, would there be costs associated for us to say, okay, we're not going to do this after all?
So the only real cost I can think of off the top of my head would be that what we're talking about with Insight and with DFA, the fees we negotiated are based on assumed asset values, and so if we come to them with different amounts, that may cause them to renegotiate and say, you know, we were at a minimum here, and so now you're looking at a number south of that, and we'd have to take that into consideration.
And there'd already be fixed costs that we have spent to get to the point, legal fees and stuff like that.
And this is not a market timing issue. This is a long-term strategy of a direction that we want ahead. So I would think that regardless of what the markets were doing, we would be moving forward with this strategy as a precursor to our long-term plan.
That's right. And so the tactical room we have around our target is the only room that we have to deviate from it. But yes, we put those guardrails in place to protect ourselves from ourselves.
I agree with you, Donna. I would agree with you. I think we have a unique situation. We may have a president who actually does what he says. And today he lifted a lot of the regulations in EPA. He's the people at the OPAL conference were talking about how, while on the trade score that made things difficult for export companies here, they thought that was going to be offset by the corporate income tax reduction and the regulatory efficiency enactments that they all expect the administration to do. And so I just think it's a time of enormous change, and no one quite knows how it comes out yet.
The thing is, though, you know, if you look back at the mid-'80s, we had a much higher yield curve than we have now. You almost would want to lock fixed income in at these higher rates. So as we progress through the year, I mean, this isn't going to happen in the next 3 weeks.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what
I mean, happens. Honestly, have we ever done anything in 3 weeks? So I would think that as we progress and as they roll out the portfolio and make the purchases on our behalf, that we would maybe get to take advantage of some of those increases in rates, the pent-up demand in the market.
Well, I hope, hopefully it's all going to come out wonderful.
Realize, too, hopefully, that this mandate, and I really keep the mandate separate in my mind, the $100 million to Insight and the $230 to DFA. There's a ton of liquidity in this mandate.
Right.
And we will never shut that door, I guess, is probably the best way to characterize it. And, in fact, we've talked about one of the flexibilities of this mandate is the fact that there is so much liquidity. So even if we were to shift or get halfway through the shift, we still have flexibility there. I would imagine that the Insight mandate is going to be funded no matter what, I would imagine. Unfortunately, the DFA mandate would be the one where we would probably, if we decided to make any tactical plays, it would come from you folks. So, but we will always have that luxury with this portfolio structure.
I don't know how you want to divide, if you want to divide these items. I, as you know, I raised earlier an issue about the Bank of New York and it's the logos on every page of the booklet. And I got an issue with a company that cheated its own clients.
We can divide the...
And I would like you, Rick, to see if where that is, actually, that whole issue, and whether there's any intent on the part of the Bank of New York to make their clients whole.
Just a quick clarifying question on that. Is there any pending or settled litigation with regards to that?
I have no idea. I don't either.
You and I discussed this 3 or 4 years ago when I first came on board.
I think it's settled.
Okay.
But I can't recall. It's been several years.
I can look into that.
It's a sign item.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to split? Would you like us to...
Well,
I won't vote for this inside until that's answered. I don't want to hold up everybody, but I don't think you should reward people for cheating you.
Gosh, they're not going to be able to work with anything.
We took their business. We took that business away from them.
Right.
And took it to Northern Trust.
Right.
Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah. Bob was a little surprised, too, like Mike, to see this company back again after we quit them from being defrauded, and now we're going to go back to them.
I just like an explanation. And it's not you guys'. I know you're not.
No, that's just apologize for not.
I apologize for not for jumping on
you a little bit. No, not at all. It's a fair question. I apologize for not being better educated on the history of the Bank of New York.
You've been watching too much of the Senate confirmation hearing, haven't you?
We do.
I don't want to
admit it.
Mike, if you decide to do whatever you can.
Look at the last actionable idea.
Yeah, I think it's over.
I believe it is. I believe it is, from my recollection. Okay, we can split this. We can split this out, and we're going to change a little bit of the language that's on the sheet here. So let's. Our first motion will be to approve the approximate allocation of $230 million to Dimensional Fund Advisors pending legal review. That's the language I want to add in there. So I'll entertain a motion in regards to that.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, motion by Donna, second by Trustee O'Neill. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. I will now, second motion will be to approve the approximate allocation of $100 million into a custom portfolio managed by Insight Investment.
Needs to be a roll call vote.
Okay. And we're going to have a roll call vote, but the additional language will be pending legal review to that motion. So we will now take a roll call vote.
We need a motion.
I'll move. I'll make that motion.
Okay. Motion by Jeff Grover.
I'll second.
Second by Donna Riley. Any further discussion? Thank you, Kelly. Now we'll do a roll call vote.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Jagan Lange?
Yes.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
And that was yes by Jeff Grover and yes by Donna Riley.
Well,
you haven't called Donna Riley yet.
Donna.
I'm sorry. So I need to repeat it after the motion?
Yeah, you should.
Because that doesn't count as it. Okay, sorry. Donna Riley?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Motion passes 8-1.
You didn't call me.
I am so sorry. I am so sorry.
She thought you were romantic.
Mandeep,
thought I was sleeping, right?
Sorry, Mandeep Dillon.
Yes.
Oh. Yes.
Still passes 8-1.
It really passes 8-1 this time.
Okay, now I'm going to combine these two. So the motion will be to authorize staff to engage Scott Smith of Hanson Bridget LLP to complete the legal review and assist with negotiation and execution of contracts with DFA and Insight, and to authorize the executive director to enter into an agreement with DFA and Insight once that legal review has been completed. Okay, there's a motion by Michael O'Neill.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, and a second by Jagan. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, we will do a roll call vote again.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Mandeep Dillon?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
Abstain.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Jagan Raja?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Motion passes 8-1 with one abstention, Mike Lynch.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I thought abstention is the same as a no.
It should be 8-0.
Okay.
Yep.
If you want to be on the scoreboard, you should do a motion with someone.
I know. I think so, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, my move. MD and MO looked the same. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you all very, very much.
You can stay if you like.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to item 7, Executive Director Investment. 7A, discussion action regarding the investment policy final draft.
Okay, staff's recommendation on this item will be to approve investment policy final draft. That's attachment 1 to your agenda item. Goodbye. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Let's wait. Okay, so in the middle of last year, Veris and Stan Sarah staff started to take a look at our current investment policy and start to recraft that policy. Given the changes in the investment governance process and the asset allocation that the board chose to implement in the middle of last year. And what we found was that the current policy was lacking in several areas, and we've highlighted three of them in the agenda item. One was the asset allocation itself, is that the current policy really formulates its strategies and philosophies based on an asset-only perspective, and the board has moved to a more liability-driven awareness of the system, and so the new policy that we've attached really addresses more of the liabilities and how Stan Sarah views its liabilities. That's one thing. Roles and responsibilities for the governance process, believe it or not, they are scattered all over the place. Some are in our bylaws, some are in our internal processes and policies, and they're just not organized correctly. Some internal processes are actually in our investment policy right now. And so this new way of looking at the policy, it modularizes the investment policy, and it only talks about philosophies and roles and responsibilities. Other things, such as policies that are more dynamic, sometimes, let me give you an example of what the problem is today. Like, say we want to say we're going to look at alternative investments a certain way. Right now, if we make a statement and we make a change in the way we view alternative investments, we have to go through the entire policy now and make sure that what we say about alternatives is only applies to alternatives, that it doesn't apply to everything else. So it's a very cumbersome, unwieldy document to be working with. So the new policy addresses that by modularizing the approach to investment governance and the policy. And so in other words, it takes certain aspects of the investment governance process and it allows us to essentially plug and play into the current investment policy. So if something changes in the way we view something or the way we administer something based on what this board wants to do, we don't have to change the entire policy. We just change what's going to be called a schedule of directives, and I'll talk about that in a second. We just changed the schedule of directives, and everything stays intact. So the investment policy is a long-term view of the way Stansera thinks about its investment, its allocation, its governance, and the roles and responsibilities. That should stay in place for quite some time, we hope, and there shouldn't be many changes to that process. So that's what this is all about. We also have that as a part of this agenda item, but it's not something that you have to approve. It's the schedule of processes. And that's a document that is more internally related. And so that gets to some of the things I was talking about earlier, stuff that staff does internally to manage the governance process, but that we don't necessarily need board approval for. It's the way we administer our business related to the governance process. Like I said, that's a part of this agenda item. It doesn't have to be approved by you because it's something that we implement internally. And then the final thing is something called the schedule of directives. And that is this collection of mini policies, and I say mini, M-I-N-I, smaller policies that are dynamic in the sense that they relate to the investment governance process, and they could change over time. And so that's a separate document that's kept outside of the investment policy. And anytime the board in the future changes the way it thinks about how it wants to invest, maybe it changes the way it feels about the use of derivatives somewhere down the road, then we don't have to go in and change the entire investment policy to accommodate that. We change that statement on the use of derivatives or investing in bonds in foreign markets. We don't have to go through and change the whole entire investment policy. That is called the schedule of directives. Those are many policies that we need to have you approve, but we don't have those all fleshed out right now, and we will be bringing you those policies as we go along down the road. There is one policy on one investment directive that's on this agenda. It comes right after this investment policy, and it talks about the asset allocation, which is something you have to give the final blessing to. So what we're talking about today is this new way look of looking at the investment policy in terms of just roles and responsibilities and the way Stansera views the investment process and its investment philosophy. That's what we're asking you to approve today in this agenda item, and I'd like you to weigh in on anything I might have missed because I know this has been a very long process. It's been a difficult process at times going back and forth on this and deciding what is a process, what is a directive, what belongs in the investment policy long term. I mean, we've been doing this for 3 months now, so we've really gotten to the point now where we feel we've got a working document, a working product here, and that's what's before you today.
You said it very well.
Great. Boy, you got off lucky on that one. All
right, good.
So I'd be happy to answer any questions or any questions you might have for Ed.
It's an awful lot to digest.
It is a lot. I think that the way we've done this now, though, is so much better than the current way we do it, because right now we have one policy, and it's almost like anything goes. And when you guys want to do something different, then we just go in and we kind of add it to the current policy, but we don't really have the time to scrutinize everything in the investment policy to make sure it jives with what the changes that you've made. So this really works well, and it helps us. It's going to help us maintain order in terms of how we document our processes, procedures, and policies.
Yeah, so I think you're saying it's easier to keep this structure internally coherent. I think that's true. I think it's also interesting because as public fund boards have turnover, and someone coming on board and reading a 13-page document is a lot less daunting than reading a 34-page document. Reading a 13-page document that is ordered in a way that clearly articulates roles and responsibilities, philosophy and objectives, and then what about this, or what about this, or what about this? Yep, we have that in directives, or we have that in procedures. So easy to point to the areas for follow-up questions, but the meat of what a trustee's responsibility is hopefully encapsulated here, unless you provide us feedback otherwise.
So the language about fees on page number 7. Is that the language? Has there been any change in it, or is it new language? Because I personally feel it's a little light. I mean, the culture, you know, in the investment industry that, you know, no matter how the fund performs, their fees are guaranteed. So I think as government systems, we need to try to change that culture. But
so you're right. That actually, the answer to that question is fleshed out more in, I believe, the directives. But yes, we get into fees, how we manage fees, and how this organization feels about fees in the directives. And so that's something that could change, you know, as part of a dynamic governance process. But it is talked about elsewhere in a schedule outside of this document.
And so what we're saying here on page 7 is not so much to take the position that fees must be minimized. That has been a common sort of verbiage used in other policy statements in the past. We all recognize that because minimizing fees doesn't add value necessarily to the plan. We don't want to pay high fees, so we want to judge fees based on the value created. And that's what it's saying here, is simply that we want to take a cost-benefit analysis to the fees we're being paid. It's very consistent with what you're doing today. I mean, Rick's value-add reports are a great example of doing exactly that.
So number 10 of the schedule of procedures, it says, Stansera staff shall endeavor to maintain overall investment fees and expenses at or below the average of similarly situated pension plans. That's a goal that we have. Now, how we achieve that goal and how we monitor that goal is a different story, but it is a goal that internal staff has regarding fees.
Thank you.
At some point, Rick, do you have a cross-reference matrix to cross-reference the directive, you know, like fees are here?
Any place in this investment policy that talks about a subject that's related to the directives, we will point to it. Okay. It's just we can't do that right now because we don't have the directive document all fleshed out.
Okay. There's your opportunity, Mandy.
All right, so I'll move.
Is there any further discussion? Entertain a motion. He did. All right. So you got that, Kelly?
He did.
I'll second.
Second by Jeff Grover. Okay, motion is second. Now, any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Move on now to item 7B, discussion and action regarding investment. This investment directive number 1, asset allocation.
All right, so this is directive number 1, the first of probably 11 or 12 that will be coming your way over the course of the next few months as we need them and as we learn more about how we want to govern certain aspects of our asset allocation. Right now, though, for us to get going on this transition, we need your blessing on the asset allocation, the current asset allocation. There's two things that's different about this than what you approved last year. One is that we have now the actual target, or the ranges around the target. When you guys approved the asset allocation last year, you only approved the target asset allocation. Now we've formed ranges around that to give us some wiggle room so we don't have to be constantly buying and selling assets. The other thing is that this asset allocation that we're asking you to approve today is phase one. It's going to take a while to transition our portfolio completely to the allocation that you folks approved late last year. So we're trying to do this in phases. And this phase is the ultimate, it's the phase that we want to reach after
the liquidity, treasury mandate, and risk parity mandates have been fulfilled. And so after we get those fulfilled and we get to this phase, then we'll move on to phase two, which is all the rest. So we're just asking you to approve phase one of the asset, current asset allocation with the allowable targets and allowable ranges.
And what we're proposing is what, 38.2% for domestic equities to go to 17.1?
Correct.
Right. And for international, 18 to go to 22.9.
That's correct. And again, this is not even the ultimate. This is just phase one.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not sure this is keeping with making America great again.
Because of the foreign investments?
Yeah.
So that's a good point, because as I mentioned earlier in response to your question, we will be bringing back our updated capital market assumptions and rerunning this model through it, which could, I would expect, will change these numbers. And then we will be progressing to phase one once we've selected the risk parity manager, which is probably another month or two away. And so we could append a date to this and say we will adopt this asset allocation once the risk parity manager has been approved or something like that, or no.
Here, my only issue on this is that we get locked into the percentages. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think we're doing that at a time when we absolutely should not be doing that. I think we have no idea what's going to happen in D.C. He's renegotiating NAFTA. He's reopened the pipeline issue with Canada. The whole ballgame has changed, and I think it's a sea change event.
I think it's a fair discussion or a fair point that Mike is bringing up. I guess I'd like to hear from the rest of the board. I mean, is this something that you feel convicted about? I mean, he's right. We set our asset allocation in a different economic regime.
And no one expected this.
So, I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, but I'd kind of like to hear what the board thinks. I mean, we need to broach this subject.
It's impossible to know.
It is impossible to know.
It's impossible.
It is.
Maybe I can answer this. Is there historical data regarding new presidency in terms of lag time, the decisions made, and you start to see the impact 6 months, 12 months, 24 months later on some of these economic decisions they're making? Obviously, we know he is making decisions, but when will we see the impact? 4 years, 8, 12?
Well, I think some of it obviously is going to need congressional action, and he's got the Congress to do that, but it still takes time. I just don't think we should do this at least for the first 100 days.
Remind me again, when are we going to look at our asset allocation model?
He wants 200.
When's that going to take place?
In the year.
Our asset allocation model, it will likely be February or March. Depends on when our capital market assumptions are finished, when we can run them through the model and get them in printed materials to you. If we can do that in February, that would be great.
This
My
February?
Expectation would be March. Yeah. Our CMAs should be ready at the end of the month.
Perfect.
So we may have enough 30 days, 60 days out. We may have enough sort of idea of things are starting to change. As you said, these numbers here, you predict are going to change.
It's a lot safer bet to anticipate they'll change than the states.
It's based on history, not future.
Well, it seems to me that what we should be considering in play are just where the equities are spread. Whether they should go outside the U.S. like we haven't planned, or stay in the U.S. If we're going to achieve what we're going to do with risk parity, we're still going to need to keep fixed income down somewhat the same. And the only difference is how do we blend these?
I agree with that.
And it seems that we have some time that we could do that. And you have some models you can run that we arrived here based on what we knew in the rearview mirror. And we've taken a little bit more time, we can make another educated guess on where it's going.
That's right.
You know, just a reminder, we still are allocating a lot of money to private equity. I'm not sure the equity exposure overall is going to be a whole lot different once we get to the final allocation.
That's a great point. So the private equity allocation in phase one is showing at zero.
Right.
But that's because private equity is a phase three event.
Exactly.
Well, we've got a pool of 20% there. Work with, and in all likelihood, if we go to some private equity, it's going to be U.S. private equity, more likely than foreign private equity.
Very high.
We will still have the exposure.
Yeah, I mean, which I think we're saying we want at this point.
Right, exactly.
If we build a wall around this place, we won't be shipping our money out of here.
One thing I want to remind everybody here is that we are a long-term viewer of the capital markets and the returns that we get. We have to be very cautious about tactical plays when we're in this game for the long term. So that's the whole...
I agree with that 100%. I think we have a change in Washington and worldwide, if you look at Europe and the EU and stuff, that has not been factored into these discussions and deliberations. I think we're going to see significant changes. And I think you bet, I mean, I'm just conservative by nature. I bet on the home team before I bet on the people in South America or Europe.
So should we have Ed bring us back some alternative facts?
I think you kind of understand what we're getting at here. So if there's something that you could put out there that we could have a healthier, lively discussion, that would be beneficial.
Yeah, I think a couple things that are interesting. One is that whenever you have an investment policy statement, there's almost this inherent need to have the asset allocation table in there somewhere. And this kind of fills that box, but recognizing that it's going to change, and it's going to change before we even start to implement, that it's kind of a placeholder. So if it's a placeholder and we want that as a placeholder, fine, we have one. If we don't want to approve this today and want to come back, we can do that too. We could follow the existing policy as far as asset allocation goes, continue on that path.
Which we're still out of compliance with.
We're out of compliance with it. The ranges of the policy aren't shown here, so we're still okay from that perspective.
Okay. I would hope that we could keep on the path we're going on, and over the next few months, if something changes, then we can talk about it. But I don't want to halt the process here, because if we don't make any changes, this is just going to put us farther and farther behind. So I would suggest that we do approve this, move on, but that doesn't lock us in 2 or 3 months down the road.
Yeah, it's part of the beauty of modular design.
And how can we approve this? The private equity shows zero, and we got so much money into that, maybe 8-10%. I don't see how we could approve something like that with what our asset allocation is now. We're not planning on getting out.
I'll let Ed answer that.
We actually don't have any private equity. We have private credit. So if you're thinking of like the Raven, Medley, that's under private credit. So that's showing at the 7%.
So that's the private
target. Yeah. Over here on this on the sheet we'll look at, it's over here in direct lending, so it's private. It's the credit instead.
Okay, I'm okay with
that. Yeah.
The only thing I'm not a little uneasy about is reducing our large cap exposure by as much as what this shows, and the unknowns to me anyway of this risk parity.
So why don't we just hold off on this until 3 months?
Hold off on any transition here?
Establishing the W. You said it didn't matter.
Well, no, I don't want to really stop the process now. I'd like to continue on. I mean, when would we actually start funding? When would we actually move money from these other buckets to risk parity, to the liquidity mandate, and to the treasury mandate?
So we are scheduled to do a risk parity search for you at the February meeting, and then the finalists come in March. If diligence takes longer, then I think they come back in April, kind of like what we just had with liquidity managers. They came back a month later than we were initially anticipated. So if we can get that done in March and then get agreements in place and everything, money probably moves end of April.
So we've got,
if there's a delay,
March, moves, over 3 months. There's 3 months to make changes. I guess I just don't want to slow the process down right now. We don't have to transfer money.
So 3 months to make changes, you're anticipating February for a new model?
February or March.
February or March, okay.
So this becomes like a placeholder, you're saying?
That's pretty much what it is.
emerging markets in risk areas?
If there aren't.
Next to nothing, maybe. Yeah.
They take a global mandate. Equity exposure, so that's largely U.S. and international developed, so maybe a sliver in there. We have more in our ACWI ex-U.S. mandates today.
I'll make a motion that we approve Directive 1 asset allocation table with ranges to be adjusted when we get our updated
asset allocation
information.
Did you get all that, Kelly?
I'll second that.
Second by Mandy. Okay. Is there any further discussion?
Well, I mean, does that mean the 38, we're not approving the 38 to 17, or does it mean we're approving the 38 to 17?
We are, but we're not going to move any money for 3 months.
Okay.
So we're heading in that direction, Mike, but that doesn't mean that it's an absolute.
It's not activated.
That's right. But it allows us to continue to put the pieces in place to move to that point.
It's a form.
Okay.
And we'll vote again when we start moving money.
Yes.
Before that.
Okay. Right? We had talked about that.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, schematically we sort of do the analysis with you, then we get the policy written, then we come back with updated analysis and a rebalancing. So this process gets kind of elongated, but we're kind of beginning to end. We're kind of in the middle now. We're getting the investment policy in place, and we want this as part of the policy in place. But before we move any money, we have to fill in these couple other blanks, like our risk parity managers, and then a rebalancing analysis. So you have
this. Well, I'm not going to take up your time, but I won't vote for that because I think it's kind of like the water board that says we need to have X water, so write me a report that justifies X water. I mean, that's what we're into this, but we pick the conclusion before we have all the information. So I'll vote against it, but I won't take any more of your time.
Okay. Any further discussion? We've had a motion and a second.
Roll call.
Yes.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Mandeep Dillon?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Darren Garrett?
Yes.
Jagan Raja?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Motion passes 8-1.
Okay, 7C has been postponed to a future meeting, so we'll now move on to item 8, Verus Investment Consultant, 8A, the November 30th, 2016 flash report.
Before I go on any further, I just wanted to introduce Glenn Kagan, who's on my team, working closely with me. Actually, all of you came on board at the same time, April of last year. So we joined in April of last year, and he has been working day and night on your plan. So it's nice that Glenn actually finally get to meet some of the folks who's been working so hard. So he was heavily involved in liquidity mandate search and collecting all sorts of input from managers, running the analysis, and all of that kind of stuff.
So who were the other folks? Just let me know.
One was, I think those two gentlemen were for app from Allianz.
Right.
From Allianz. Sometimes we have managers sit in on meetings and just hear what's going on.
Those are the guys that are like, okay.
Maybe we're going to move money from them.
Probably prepared.
That's where I thought it was going to come from.
So we have the November and December flash reports, and we're also in the process of putting together the fourth quarter reports. So we'll have more detail and more fully vetting here. We see that Jackson Square Partners pulled back a little bit in the month of December, both November and December. So prior, I think third quarter, they had a nice rebound, and now we're seeing that come back a little bit more. You can see the various performance of the other managers. So top line, though, is looking pretty good. From a fiscal year-to-date basis, 6.3% net of fees. Year-to-date, 7.7% net of fees. On page two, I would highlight, and this is important because it's really part of our plan in terms of the asset allocation of where we're heading, is that we have the allocations for real estate and direct lending, infrastructure. We're going to be building in a private equity portfolio. More and more of these securities are really measured on a quarterly basis. And so monthly reporting used to be informative and good to know. Now it's starting to become a little bit misleading. And so I want to caution you about that, because when we have so many blanks, and we don't want to fill in zeros, because zero is as wrong as a plus 10 or a minus 10, so we don't want to guess at it. We have these blanks. And monthly reporting is a difficult thing to do when we have so many quarterly reported funds in the plan. A number of plans have opted to go just to quarterly. Just stick with quarterly. If there are issues with managers, I'm bringing them to you. We're in contact with the managers. We know about the personnel changes, and you've heard about a number of those over the years. We can still have the managers come and present the monthly schedule that we've had. But the monthly reporting in terms of total plan is a challenge. And so today I think we're making some caveats and highlighting that these things are not included. Going forward, I think we should really give it a second thought in terms of is it really picking the right picture for us in terms of misleading. So I'll just leave that with you today, because we haven't built out the portfolio with these others yet, but I think you can see what I'm saying, and we'll see that continue to evolve.
Can you, I noticed this, and I know I asked you at lunch, can you explain why Dodge and Cox's excess return is so huge relative to their benchmark?
Yes. So Dodge and Cox, we were watching them have some pretty significant underperformance and then whipsawed back pretty significantly. And they are a low turnover strategy. So just because things were down didn't mean they sold them. They stayed with them. And when the markets recovered, those same stocks recovered. And so it was a case of them riding out the bottoms that they do. And so they stuck with their knitting, essentially what we pay them to do, and it is paying off.
So their portfolio had better rebounding stocks than the index.
Yes. Okay. So you think of them as more of the value play in the portfolio. It's a value-based strategy. They're going to have more materials, which rebounded pretty significantly, more consumer staples, more telecom, more utilities, those kinds of higher dividend things. And actually, they're low on utilities, but it was those kinds of value plays that came back nicely for them. No other personnel issues across any of the managers, no other issues to report.
Can I just ask a question? You were talking about the quarterly reporting thing, but those that do not, that are on quarterly reporting, that's only about 10% of the portfolio?
Yeah.
So, given the other 90%, I still, personally, I like to see that, you know, well, at least 90% of the portfolio generated, you know, 6.3 or whatever.
Well, and that 10% is going to increase, which is why I'm highlighting it today.
It covers 20%.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, 30%, I think, when we get to the end.
I see.
Okay. Is that for November?
And December.
Yeah. Okay. We'll move on to item 9, Executive Director Administrative 9A, Legal and Legislation Update.
And Don Lee is going to present this agenda item.
Okay. In September of 2016, Assembly Bill 2833 was approved and became code section 75147 of the government code. So this new law was intended to increase transparency. And the law mandates that every public investment fund that invests in alternative investments, that we must now require that to have those investors disclose certain information. The information is very specific, and they've given us a list of what is required. It must be reported at least annually during a public meeting, and that some of the things that they are requiring are a lot of the things that we're already reporting, such as the fees and expenses that the public fund has invested in and pays directly to the alternative investment vehicle. the fund manager or related parties. But there are some new things as well, such as the pro rata share of fees and expenses that are being paid to the alternative investment vehicle to the fund manager or related parties. And if, oops, that wasn't, that one I believe we're also doing. It's the pro rata share of the carried interest distributed to the fund manager or related parties, and the pro rata share of aggregate fees and expenses paid by all of the portfolio companies held within the alternative investment. So some of these things are information that we have not reported in the past, and if we have the information ourselves, we could compile that data, but much of this we don't have ourselves, so it will fall to the investment managers to provide this information to us. This law went into effect January 1st.
So I was at a CEO roundtable last Friday, and this is a pretty huge topic that's going on out there. And as Don said, we report about three-fourths already to you guys in that alternative report of what is required by law. However, the carried interest, and in particular, the fees that these investment managers get from loaning our money to them, some of these people who borrow money from our, like Raven, for example, like who borrow money from Raven, who borrow from us indirectly through Raven, they actually pay a fee to get secure some of these loans. And so the word is that they think that there's going to be a large majority of these alternative managers who are not going to want to disclose this stuff. And so we're not sure how we're going to be dealing with this. I'm scheduled to talk with our investment attorney about this matter next week. But the fear is that some of these alternative managers may feel California is not a market we want to be in if we have to go through this disclosure. And so the fear is that some of these managers will actually pull out of the California market. So there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that we're going to be working out and reporting back to you as we learn more ourselves.
What prompted the legislation?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question.
Somebody had a bone to pick somewhere.
Maybe.
Those fees would be excessive if they're thinking about pulling out of California.
Yeah. What?
Transparency.
Rick, in the case of the people that we've hired to manage our money, I would have assumed that if there is a fee that comes back, that's considered as a revenue stream on the money we've lent, and it just goes into everything else. Do you think that there are scenarios where that fee is being used as a backdoor directly to the manager?
That's exactly what we think could be the issue. We don't know, and if the resistance that's anticipated from these managers is realized, then it could be very
suspicions
well
confirmed.
Because of that reason.
So we don't want to do business with those folks anyhow.
Right. And so going forward, now we're in a good spot right now, mm-hmm. because this law, the way I read it, and I read it over 2 or 3 times, as long as you're not making any more contributions to a fund, you don't have to worry about it. So we only have one fund right now that we're making contributions to, and that's Raven 3.
The open.
Right. So I'm going to talk with Josh. After I talk with Scott Smith, I'm going to talk with Josh and Tom and find out what their take is on this. But then going forward, we just put this in our contract agreement going forward. So if they don't want to do it, then we don't hire them.
This tells them. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're in a decent spot right now because we only have one we got to worry about. And fortunately, the one we've got to worry about, they're generally the ones that are the most transparent or have been the most transparent in the past. And I can tell you as a side, which I don't know if this is relevant, but my wife has already talked to Raven because Merced is invested in their fund, and she said they've been very forthcoming with respect to the information that's being requested. She's actually a step ahead of me on this, but I want to talk to my legal counsel first before I reach out to our managers and discuss it more with them.
John seems to have a tendency to tell you more information
exactly
than he needs to rather than less.
Correct. But I've never asked him directly about fees that their portfolio needs to pay them. So we'll see.
Any further discussion?
Rick, I saw there's no budgetary impact. How much work is this going to be putting on staff?
Well,
I know we've talked fast about things just keep coming in terms of requirements for your staff.
That's a good point.
I guess as soon as we find out what it is we're going to have to do, then I'll be able to answer that question more. But you're right. But at this point, I have no clue of what it would cost.
It's more on the manager than anything.
It is.
Here's the law.
It is. I mean, we'll have to obviously try to interpret what they're saying and report it out to you. So.
Anything else? Seeing none, moving on to 9B, Information Technology Solutions ITS Project Update.
And this one's Don Lees again.
I'm very happy to report that the project kickoff occurred earlier this month, and we are in it with all both feet in it right now. We have started this project, and we are going full steam ahead. We have people here from Tegrit and from Linea Solutions, and so anytime you come to the office now, you'll probably see people working here. We are the first part of the project, the first major part. We're doing is the scanning project, the ECM, so we're going all electronic. And so the Tegrit has subcontracted that to another company that will be coming in the first week in March to start actually scanning our back files. So very, very large project right off the bat. In the meantime, we have our Linea folks here helping to write all of the requirements for the next phases that are coming up as well. And we have Tegrit staff here working directly with our subject matter experts and collecting data. They've already started reviewing our database. So everyone, it's like we're going forward with so many things at once. It's kind of overwhelming, but it's very exciting to see this project getting off to such a great start.
And you got 2 years to complete them.
2 years to get them complete?
Yeah.
We're going to be working really fast. Yeah, we have kind of a pretty aggressive schedule, actually.
But it's flexible.
Yes, it is flexible, but we're going to do everything we can to stay on schedule so that we don't incur any additional costs.
And just to let you know that Mike O'Neill is a part of the steering committee that's been formed, that we're going to meet each morning before these board meetings. And Mike and everybody else will learn and understand the risks that we may be facing at certain points in time, and mitigation strategies on those risks. So you do have a representative on the steering committee to make sure that Stansair's interests are best being served.
So if we do it wrong, then he goes to jail on our behalf.
It's your fiduciary.
Perfect.
Yeah, okay. It ain't gonna be done wrong.
Also, they are gonna post minutes of these. They're gonna have weekly meetings, and they're gonna have a post on the website or someplace.
SharePoint.
Yeah, SharePoint. So that anybody who's interested in going in and looking at what's going on in the day-to-day nuts and bolts stuff can do that.
And any of you, if you want access to that, you can. We already found out that Mike can have access outside of Stansair, so he can do it at home, so he can see everything that's going on. And I encourage you, if you want to do that, do it. I would like it, actually.
So just let us know, and we can get you set up with a login to the SharePoint site.
Okay, moving on to item 9C, discussion action to accept the 2017 Executive Director Goal.
So 2 months ago, the board approved the final strategic plan for 2017-2019, and this item represents those goals from the strategic plan and ongoing tasks that we are setting out to accomplish this year. The main theme of the goals that I want to get done this year are focused on assuring a successful implementation of the pension project. Even though it won't be complete for another 3 or 4 years, I want to get us on the right track and take steps, and we've set goals to make sure that we are progressing in the right fashion. And then also the goals this year are focused a lot on investment governance. I think those two things are the biggest things this organization faces. The document is divided into ongoing, which are things that we generally do every year, but nonetheless, it's nice to have goals related to those ongoing administrative tasks. and those explicitly tied to the plan, as I alluded to earlier. And then during the year, as always, each quarter, we will report out on how well we've done achieving those goals, the progress made throughout the year, and when and if any resolutions are realized. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions on that?
I would make a motion that we accept the executive director's goals as presented.
We have a motion by Jeff Grover. Is there a second?
I'll second.
I'll give it to you. But you've been no most of the day. We'll let you second one in the affirmative. All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Approved. Okay. We have been noticed by the executive director that item 10A for closed session has been pulled to the next month's meeting. Are there any further items for closed session?
Yeah, I have a report on item 10B.
Okay.
I move to move into closed session.
Motion to move into closed session. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Sam Sharp. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved.
Who knows how to shut?
Okay, we've moved back into open session, and we have nothing to report out from closed session. Okay, we'll move on to item 11, members forum, information of future agenda requests.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I went to the Opal conference, and I was there with Mr. O'Neill, and I found it very interesting. The investment people there who spoke are as confused about what might happen as I am and we are. But they all expect it to be different than it has been before. I found it really fascinating, and I really enjoyed it. The only other item I'd like to mention is I think we need to take seriously this Bank of New York issue. I think
seriously about what?
The Bank of New York.
Oh.
The people who cheat their own clients, I have a problem with. So I hope they give you some information.
You're not banking with Wells Fargo either.
No.
There's a lot of banks that cheat their customers, and Wells Fargo was another one. I think J.P. Morgan was another one that was fined. Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, they were big cheaters.
No, I mean they're all a bunch of crooks. And
Rick, I think
they banks.
I think what we should know is that I suspect that the people that were guilty of fraud probably got to spend some time in the prison, and there probably have been some penalties that were mandated on Bank of New York, and they probably, in light of the fact that the last 8 years have been very onerous on financial institutions, if there have been changes made in the law and that sort of thing, I think it'd be healthy for us to know that.
Okay.
Because I don't think we're near the risk of being defrauded now that we would have been before it happened.
Okay.
No, yeah, I don't think they're going to defraud us. I think
all the same people.
I just don't want to reward them.
And I think an update in regards to this issue. I'm with Fred. I seem to recall it's all been settled.
Yeah, but I'll
find out. We need to find that out.
Let me ask you this. Maybe I can frame it this way. Is there anything that I potentially could uncover that would make you think differently about investing our money with Insight?
I think they should make our fund whole.
Bank of New York Mellon?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that's going
to
happen.
I know, but I think we should ask them to.
Well, you can bring that up when it, you know, comes back on the discussion again.
I guess I'm more concerned about our faith in giving Insight $100 million. That's really what I'm concerned about.
Well, it troubles me.
Okay.
Right. Fred, anything?
No.
John? Jeff?
A couple things. One is, Kelly, I'd like to know the details on Dimensionals education that's coming up late April.
Perfect. I marked that down to be able to distribute that to you.
And would it behoove us to introduce the visitors that are sitting around the room? Because we had two or three people that went through the entire meeting, got up and left, and we don't know who they were or why they were here.
You can ask them.
Are we allowed?
Yeah, you can.
I think the chair could ask them to introduce themselves at the beginning of the meeting.
Okay.
You know, when he's going through his disclaimers.
Okay.
So that we know that there was a gal sitting over here that maybe she's part of your staff or something.
Courts.
I believe she's Tracy McGuire from the courts.
Okay.
Okay.
So I think it'd be good if we knew who was here.
Well, and I think to add to that, it would be good to have a transparent record on who's at the meeting. So I agree with that.
And Rick, do we have a date on the Raven meeting? Have they confirmed?
No, last I heard it was like April 20th, but they have not put out a solid date yet.
I'm hesitant to buy airfare until they tell us.
Sure.
But I'd like to get the airfare. So. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to do anything until we know for sure, but so they have not given us a definitive date.
Jim?
I think we're well on our way of making America great again.
Is that a political statement, Mr. DeMartini?
Personal statement.
My own personal thought.
Okay.
Item 10A.
Yeah, wait, anything else, Jim? Or do we dare? That's it?
No, that's optimistic enough.
All right. Mike?
Item 10A is coming back. Should you want to collect these up so you don't print them again?
Yeah, just leave them out.
Well, no, we'll have to print them again because there's probably things that are changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But you can still leave them.
Okay.
That's it.
I'm going to give the two editorials from San Jose Mercury News because each and every week, San Jose Mercury News coming after this pension scheme, efforts, and yet I'm going to give this big title.
Okay. Thank you.
Nothing about payday lending, right?
No. No, I don't know that. No.
Just couldn't help yourself.
Sam
Sharp.
Nothing.
Nothing for me.
Nothing. Donna?
I want to go over to Farmland French.
Yeah, I do too.
Donna already purchased her airline ticket while we were sitting here. I'm just kidding. She's halfway there.
I'll go if you want to go. If I brought something.
Do we have to get that approved for education?
Boy, I don't think so. That's really in line with the portfolio management and their philosophy.
Will we get points for it?
For that, I
great.
I'd like to say, yes, you will.
To the that dimensional education.
Yeah, Jeff's already request, so we'll get that all out.
I definitely want to go to that.
Don?
You hate off the hook. No, there's so much going on.
Kelly?
I have nothing.
Okay. The only thing I'll add is that Rick and I, as part of his director goals for 2017, was keeping updated on our pending litigation. So he and I are going down to Fresno to the Fifth District Court of Appeals tomorrow because we have a hearing on one of our cases. So Rick and I will be leaving early tomorrow morning to get down there in time to sit through that.
Tell Chuck Bushigi and Jim and I sell a lot.
I if given the opportunity, I will do that. So, okay. Beyond that,
I'm going down there in another month or two.
Nothing else. Meeting is adjourned.